COVID-19 vaccines have helped protect us. Over time, the antibodies created after vaccination have been found to decrease. While we still have good protection against severe illness, a booster dose produces more antibodies that can help to strengthen our immune response. A booster dose is the best way to help protect yourself against severe illness related to COVID-19. Learn more and book your booster dose at canada.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the Government of Canada.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to this podcast with Dr. Samah Jaber, a Palestinian psychiatrist, psychotherapist, and writer from Jerusalem. She works in the West Bank as the director of the mental health unit at the Palestinian Ministry of Health. Dr. Jaber has insight into the health situation in Gaza, given that she trains mental health professionals there. I will discuss the topic of mental health in Gaza with Dr. Jaber. Hello, Dr. Jaber. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for your interest and thanks for shedding a light about mental health and the situation in Gaza.
Absolutely. It's an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. To start, can you tell us a bit about your journey in the field of mental health in Palestine and what drew you to work in this field?
I grew up in the home that is interested in the field of psychology. My father is specialized in educational psychology. And he used to be a university professor. And we had lots of books related to psychology, and I enjoyed reading the topic. But the decision to specialize in psychiatry was made at medical school. I studied medicine in the first medical school that was made for Palestinians. And I studied during the time of the Second Intifada. And as I was doing my rotations in internal medicine and pediatrics, I noticed that so many people come to see the doctors for somatization, for medically unexplained symptoms. And I realized that there is a big connection between the aches and pains of people and the hardships that they were going through during the daily bombardment that was taking place in the Second Intifada. And then I decided to specialize in psychiatry, and I went to France for my specialty. And as I was studying psychiatry, I developed a special interest in psychotherapies. So I also have a training in cognitive behavioral therapy and a three-year training in psychoanalytic psychotherapy. I finished my studies in France and started working in Palestine by the end of 2006. For a while, for 10 years, I worked as the director of the Ramallah Community Mental Health Center, and then as the director of the mental health unit, which is responsible for mental health activities that are run by the Palestinian Ministry of Health.
Thank you for sharing that. And in your journey towards coming to this field, are there any people in or out of Palestine that really inspired you or guided your work and your interpretations of how to practice medicine?
Well, of course, as I studied abroad, I had teachers and supervisors outside Palestine. But the first inspiration was by a doctor working here in Palestine at the psychiatric hospital, Dr. Yvonne Lamley. And I liked the way she practiced, and I encountered her as a medical student. And then as I studied abroad, I met with excellent teachers and supervisors. I've been always interested in reading about different subjects in the field of mental health. Coming from different countries, the practice of this profession in different countries. And I realized early on in my career that the practice of mental health needs to be contextualized. The theories that developed in the West and were relevant to the situation of people in the West does not necessarily work for us here. So I've been involved in the thinking of contextualizing the mental health practice in Palestine, where we have very small number of staff, where Palestine is considered as a low middle income country with very minimal resources and a very small investment in the field of mental health, and adapting the practice and the policies of mental health to this particular situation in Palestine. And above all, the situation of political violence that brings trauma upon so many people. And of course, there are severe psychological consequences for this situation.
Absolutely. And I'd like to pick up on this point of contextualization that you brought up. In your work, you challenge the limits of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, as a diagnostic and an explanatory model in the context of the situation in Gaza and in Palestine broadly. Can you speak more to how we can understand PTSD in a place like Gaza where traumatic conditions are ongoing?
I think the diagnosis PTSD that was coined in 1980 best captures the experience of a soldier who fights away from his homeland, goes back to safety, but continues to feel the threat in his mind, continues to have flashbacks, nightmares, hypervigilance, avoidance. Now, this is not the situation of Palestinians. Palestinians cannot escape the real threat in the reality. The threat was never imaginary or only in their mind or only in flashbacks and nightmares. So the violence is ongoing. And of course, there are serious traumatic reactions, but they don't look like PTSD. And in some, we can find a broad spectrum of reactions to trauma, anxiety, depression, and sometimes profound changes in personality and in the prospect to the world, in their understanding of the world. I work with people who experience torture in prisons during interrogation. I work with families who live a traumatic grief because they lost some family members and they don't know what happened to them. They just disappeared and they are left to assume what could have happened to them. And many of these people, they deal with the trauma from the past, but they continue to experience other traumas in Gaza, for example. Over the past 10 years, there has been a few serious attacks and wars on the people. It doesn't target soldiers, it targets the civilian population. Gaza is a closed zone and there is no escape. Even in the time when there is no military attack and no war, the humanitarian situation is made extremely difficult for people. So many people have food insecurity. There are cuts in electricity, no clean water to drink for big neighborhoods. For many people, they don't have access to clean water most of the time. So the life is made extremely difficult. These situations, this description of reality does not amount to a traumatic event, but it is an ongoing distress that makes the life of people extremely difficult. It is a closed zone to a very, it's a highly dense situation, and people cannot get out of Gaza. Many people need to access healthcare outside Gaza, but it is made extremely difficult for them. Sometimes they are forced to make important compromises on their way to outside the border of Gaza to have healthcare. There are reports from Physicians for Human Rights, for example, say that some people were refused healthcare because they didn't agree to collaborate and be informants to the Israeli security system. So that's the kind of hardship that people endure in Gaza. But we need to be careful. Not everyone who goes through hardships becomes sick, develops a mental health disorder. There is a lot of psychological suffering, and some people get sick. An important percentage of people get sick, and they need a lot of help, but not only psychological help, humanitarian help, and a political solution. And it's very important to understand that to look at the situation in Gaza as a situation of illness and disease and mental health crisis while ignoring the political reality and not providing solutions for the political reality is in a way a contribution to this attack on the humanity of the people in Gaza.
I was wondering if you could speak more to how people in Gaza are coping with this, how they're coping to these attacks on their humanity, and how they're coping with, you know, really kind of an international ignorance to the political situation and the political reality, and how that's affecting not only people's health or their psychosomatic symptoms that they experience, but their everyday life, as you said, this ongoing distress that they have to live with.
First, let me share with you that my latest experience in Gaza. 2 weeks ago, I came back from Gaza. I was in a mission. It was the first time I go to Gaza, in fact. I went there. I was recruited by one of the international NGOs to train the staff, the psychologists that work for the Minister of Health, and also the counselors that work in schools. And the subject, the topic was childhood trauma. And I was amazed at the capacities that people have. They are hardworking people, really engaged in their work, enthusiastic about their profession. They want to help others. I was impressed. We go to teach in Gaza, to train, and there is a lot for me to learn from the colleagues and from the patients there. Another thing that left an impact on me is this experience of crossing the border from the Israeli-occupied port to Gaza, crossing Erez a checkpoint. It's like I crossed it in 25 minutes, 30 minutes. When you cross the checkpoint of Erez, you feel that you are crossing two places that are one century apart from each other. Fancy homes, fancy cars on the Israeli side. You see carts and animals on the Palestinian side. You see young people who are amputee, who lost their limbs when they participated in the Great March of Return. Their presence is very visible. You go through the neighborhoods, and it's very common that you see at least two, three people every time I went out. You see the suffering, you see the poverty, and at the same time, the kindness and the eagerness for people in Gaza to meet with an outsider.
I know that you're a practitioner, so you're in a position where you not only need to be there for people and help them, provide medical care for them, you also need to train other people, as you said, like practitioners in Gaza. What kind of impact does this have on you, like personally? You know, because you're human too, and like you said, you were educated during the Second Intifada. Like, how does this kind of impact you and your work and the approach to what you do?
Let me say a few things about the role, the different roles that I play in the field of mental health in Palestine, and the impact this has on me. So I, as we have very few practitioners in Palestine, so I have to do a lot of work. In my role at the Minister of Health, I'm a policymaker in mental health. Like, I'm responsible for developing national strategies for suicide prevention, a mental health response to COVID-19. I coordinate between different organizations working in the field of mental health. And I also have a big load of clinical work in the private sector. I also work as a consultant for some NGOs where I train staff and supervise them. I'm very passionate about the work that I do for several reasons. One of them is because I view that the liberation of Palestine requires us to heal the minds of people that have been occupied and traumatized for several generations. So I see my work as a contribution to the mental liberation and a contribution to the overall project of the liberation of Palestine. The other reason why I like this work is because I have always been curious about human behavior, and I'm interested in comparing the work that I see here in Palestine with the things that I learned in the Western education in mental health. I see many similarities, but I see some differences. And I like to elaborate on these differences because I believe that Palestine is a place to teach mental health. We have things to share with others and teach to others, implementing a mental health strategy in a situation where there is violence, little resources invested in mental health, and very small number of practitioners. Those are tough situations, and we are doing the art of the possible. We are doing what can be done in this situation, and I think this can inspire many colleagues outside Palestine. One more thing that I want to say. I'm not only a psychiatrist and a mental health professional, I'm also a Palestinian citizen. And I experience the political violence on my skin, like other Palestinians. Now, my understanding in psychotherapy is that the aim of man-made trauma, like wars and political violence, is to impose helplessness on us. So as I engage in the heavy work that I do in Palestine, this is my healthy reaction to trauma. I'm not helpless. I don't feel helpless. And I know that the overall objective of political violence is to make me helpless. And my work is my agency. It's my response to the difficult situation. And I hope that in providing support to my patients, I also help them to regain their agency. So it's a healthy reaction to the man-made trauma that we face in Palestine.
That was really beautifully said. Thank you. Building off of this, you mentioned that there are lessons to be learned from the case of Palestine. How do you think these lessons can be communicated and shared with the rest of the world and to the broader field that you're working with?
I hope that this podcast is one way to share the Palestinian experience with others, but also myself and several of my colleagues are involved in scholarly writings about the situation in Palestine and providing mental health services in Palestine. We draw many conclusions from anti-colonial psychotherapy and anti-colonial contexts. And at the same time, we make our own observations and our own reflections on the situation that where we work here in Palestine. So this is what we do to share with others. We participate in conferences. We speak about the situation in Palestine. Many of us understand that political advocacy is also an integral part of our role as health providers and mental health providers, because we understand that man-made violence and political violence is the most important pathogen against the well-being of people. So we do all the necessary clinical work that we practice in our daily life, but we also speak up against racist policies and political violence. I can add one more thing about how do we practice in Palestine, given the small number of professionals. So we train many people in the helping profession to provide low intensity psychotherapeutic interventions. So we have many teachers in Palestine. We train teachers to intervene, to provide psychological first aid during crisis time, to teach social skills for children, to do some interventions in group setting to help people recover from trauma. We train also clergy and religious leaders who are usually consulted before the psychiatrist, when people face some mental health issues or relational problems within a family. So we draw on the capacities of these people and the trust relationship between them and the community. And we try to provide a lot of help in the community. This in addition to a more specialized training that we provide for primary health doctors and nurses, because those are also trusted people by the community. And usually a person who suffers from somatization, aches and pains that are related to health, to a psychological situation, they go to see the primary doctor and the nurse before they come to the psychiatrist. So we made profound trainings for doctors in the West Bank and in Gaza so that they can provide counseling and low intensity intervention and even psychiatric treatment for common disorders like the and we try to bypass the stigma and the apprehension from the psychiatric hospital and the psychiatric clinics and make promote mental health literacy among people, and at the same time make the health, the mental health interventions accessible by people everywhere.
Can you speak more to the kinds of stigmas or challenges you face, either between, you know, living under Israeli occupation or in the case of Gaza, Israeli siege, and also with the community, any kinds of stigma or challenges that you might face in the practicing of your work?
Stigma is an, a universal problem. Stigma associated with mental health is a universal thing. And I think in each context, it takes a special shape. In Palestine, I will give one example that is related to our context. We realize that many people come out of prison, political imprisonment, which is very prevalent in Palestine, like 20% of the Palestinian population experienced political detention. And torture and mistreatment is commonplace. So when people come out of prison, they are given the status of a hero by the Palestinian society. But at the same time, they have a lot of suffering, and it becomes more stigmatizing for them to be told that you are sick, you need psychiatric treatment. That's why we try to provide psychosocial support for them outside the psychiatric clinics and the mental health centers. So the minors who spend some time in prison, we try to engage them in clubs or in sport coaching where they get support and counseling by older people, by adults who experienced imprisonment themselves and who are familiar with the situation in prison. So that's one way to bypass the stigma in our context. And there are a few more examples.
So I know that there are organizations such as like We Are Not Numbers in Gaza that work to address the severe underrepresentation in media of Palestinian voices, while also kind of working to address stigma and perhaps kind of mitigate the effects of stigma. What kind of role, if any, do you think that the media can play in reshaping narratives about mental health, both within the community, but also international perceptions of mental health in Gaza and beyond?
I think that a lot has been achieved in that direction. I started practicing as a specialized psychiatrist 14, 15 years ago in Palestine. And I see that people talk more openly now about mental health issues. And we take advantage of any opportunity of a big event that takes place in Palestine to educate people about mental health. I work often with media. We speak on media to promote mental health literacy.
Well, I hope that these conversations around mental health continue to be discussed openly, and there is no doubt in my mind that your efforts and the efforts of your colleagues will make an impact now and for generations to come. Thank you for joining, Dr. Javed, and for making the time to be here and share your insights today. It is deeply appreciated.
Thank you for your interest, and thanks for shedding a light about mental health and the situation in Gaza.
You've been listening to Status Audio Magazine. The Status is produced by the Arab Studies Institute in partnership with Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, co-sponsored by George Mason University's Middle Eastern Studies Program and the American University of Beirut's Asfari Institute for Civil Society and Citizenship. To listen to more conversations, on-the-scene reports, and discussions, visit our website, statushour.com, or subscribe via iTunes and listen to us on the go. You can also friend us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Thanks for listening, and for more conversations, please visit statushour.com. Thank you.
Nah, nah, nah.
In recent years, the doxing of Palestinians on Twitter has gained traction as a tactic by far-right Zionist organizations. This tactic has resulted in the complete weaponization of social media against Palestinians. Everything from your tweets to your Facebook posts, to even your Instagram likes, can be used against you by far-right Zionist actors who will put together an elaborate profile of individuals with so-called evidence of their anti-Semitism. The conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism runs rampant on these blacklist websites and their affiliated Twitter accounts. Social media is becoming an increasingly hostile place for Palestinians. Young Palestinian Americans are finding themselves being fired from jobs, expelled from universities, and having to deal with libel that's circulated about them for years on the internet. It has been shown as well that Israel oftentimes pulls up the profiles of Palestinian Americans on these Zionist blacklist websites when these individuals attempt to visit their homeland, and they are oftentimes denied entry. What happens in the digital sphere is having a material impact on Palestinians. This is a growing problem of free speech, digital rights, and academic freedom. I spoke with three Palestinian American students who have been targets of right-wing Zionist blacklists and their affiliated websites. The first person I spoke with was Omar. Omar is a writer, poet, independent scholar, and organizer. He's the education and advocacy coordinator for Eyewitness Palestine and is a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement and the U.S. Campaign for the Cultural and Academic Boycott of Israel. Omar holds a PhD in comparative literature from the University of California, Los Angeles. The first thing I asked Omar was how being included on a blacklist like Canary Mission has impacted his life.
I think, you know, I'm in a very fortunate camp because Canary Mission did not affect me at all. And, you know, and this is something that I was going to touch on earlier, but I forgot to. But I think part of it, too, is that it's just, it's so ridiculous. You know, it's not just the act of being blacklisted, but if you actually go through the site, like, this is really a fanatically far right project. And it's very clear, not even just in terms of how they talk about Palestine, but how they talk about, you know, the Muslim Students Association, for example, the way that they throw around, you know, accusations of terrorism. Like, it's clearly a fanatic far right project. Anybody with any sense is not going to believe this, right? And unfortunately, our problem is that a lot of people don't have sense, especially when it comes to Palestine. All of a sudden, the things, the convictions they have, they become like these very basic platitudes, right? And it's something I've always thought of as being kind of the magic of Israel. Like, you can have this very nuanced understanding of power dynamics and capitalism, but then when you start talking about Palestine, it becomes the most juvenile, you know, not even political analysis. It's as well, you know, isn't it complicated? Well, you know, don't Jews and Muslims just not like each other, right? Like, so people have a very underdeveloped political analysis when it comes to Palestine. And of course, that's not an accident, right? That's a effect of, you know, corporate media, you know, of imperialism using corporate media as a tool. So that's kind of the the lay of the land, you know, where we find ourselves. But, you know, that sense of this is just so ridiculous, I'm not going to give it any time, I'm not going to take it seriously, I think helped because, you know, I kept working with SJP. I kept writing about Palestine. You know, I finished graduate school and now I work for a nonprofit, you know, currently where we do delegations to Palestine. So, you know, and what we saw in May, I think was very galvanizing and inspiring for a lot of people because we know that when we're united together, we're unstoppable, right? And these things really happen when there's a fear, when there's a paranoia, right? We've rejected the Oslo paradigm. We know we're not divided. We know we're united together in a liberation struggle. And call us, that's it. Nobody's going to take it away anymore. You know, whether it's Canary Mission or whether it's, you know, Abbas himself, like call us, you know, it's all the same. So I think that really whatever we can do to just inculcate that sense in everybody that we're all together, you know, and these things have always been tactics that Zionists will use to try and intimidate and delegitimize us, you know, but they're not going to work because, you know, we're bound together by a cause for justice and liberation.
The next person I spoke with was Rasha. Rasha is a PhD candidate in chemistry at Johns Hopkins University. She has taught over 200 students as a graduate student and was promoted to head TA for her stellar work. In November of 2020, she became the subject of an international smear campaign by pro-Israel groups that has entailed death threats and attempts to get her fired.
Almost a year later, the Zionist lobby has not let up on their attacks against her. Despite these attacks, Russia continues her research into more ethical next-generation batteries. She demonstrates what it means to be a successful Palestinian in a field entrenched in Zionism and aims to bring in an anti-militarist lens to her work. I asked Russia, what happened to her? Who began this international smear campaign? And what has the impact of this campaign been on her professional life as a graduate student and her personal life as an organizer?
Basically, what happened with me is this anonymous individual reported me to my department and then subsequently notified many different organizations. Those organizations include the Brandeis Center, Stand With Us, Stop Anti-Semitism, and Canary Mission. Those are the ones that I am mostly aware of. They claim to be from Canada and whatever. The first clue that I had that this might start getting bigger than just like a complaint to the department was not even until January. So this was like November 20th, but I didn't have a clue that it was gonna get big until January. I thought it was gonna be a very traditional, we posted on you, posted about you, we reported you to your department. They won't leave me alone about my, they won't leave me alone about my tweets. And their recent demand to the university is that the university break FERPA and share the outcome of my case. And on top of that, for the university administration to accept IHRA as definition of anti-Semitism. I think a lot of people right now are really, really scared of Canary Mission. And it's been a really big theme that I've been hearing over the course of the Intifada of like people not wanting to do things because they're scared of Canary or like curbing their language or things like that. I think that's giving Canary Mission a lot more power than they actually have. And I'm literally like, I can't, there's not like every single one of my nightmares has come true of like being smeared. And ones that I didn't even imagine, and I'm still a functional human being. Like, I'm still in my program, like, I'm still doing my research, I'm still a chemist, like, that hasn't changed. And I think people need to, like, the liberation struggle always requires risk. And we have to be willing to take on those risks. And even if Canary Mission writes a gigantic profile on you, even if you have articles in the Times of Israel and Jerusalem Post and the Washington Post and all this shit, then that doesn't mean that you can't live your life and you should still keep going.
Finally, I spoke with Yasmin. Yasmin is a 21-year-old Palestinian civil engineering student at the University of Southern California. Her political views and social media posts have subjected her to targeted harassment by the Zionist lobby that has led to punishment from her university, extended media attention, and an FBI visit to her home. It's worth noting that Yasmin, like Russia and many others, was utilizing an anonymous Twitter account before she was doxxed by Stop Anti-Semitism and Canary Mission. That Twitter account had no outward affiliation to her university, yet once she was doxxed, her university removed her from a position, and efforts by the same Zionist organizations who doxxed her continued to remove her from her position as a DEI senator.
The account was completely anonymous at the time. I had no photos of myself, no like school, no nothing. Here's the mistake that I made though. I had my Instagram and Twitter handles were both the same, and I didn't have anything about my school or anything like that on my Instagram either. But in the people that I follow some organizations from my school, and they ended up scrolling through one org that I was in 2 years ago and found me posted as a board member. And they somehow knew that it was me. And I'm not exactly sure how or why, but the tweets, usually when someone tweets something, it's like the next day, like Canary Mission gets it or like whoever gets it and posts it. For me, it was like a tweet from a month earlier. So it took them a whole month to find out who I was. And the screenshot was old. So I know that they took the screenshot and they searched for a month to find out who I am. And they finally found it and it was like treasure for them. And they kept posting it over and over and over, same one.
Yasmin has since been in a legal battle with her university. She's been supported by Palestine Legal and FIRE, a free speech nonprofit.
I ended up getting on Canary Mission sometime, I believe, last month, so in October. And that's when FIRE reached out to me, which is just like, you know, organization, like the free speech organization that defends students on college campuses. They ended up reaching out to me, and I asked my lawyer at Pali Legal, hey, do you think I would be able to speak with them? I got consent for that and everything. And the case was passed over to them. So they ended up writing this 10-page long letter to USC on why they're wrong for their stance. And we gave them a deadline of November 15 to respond. So we gave them a few weeks, and they ended up asking to get time till November 19. So this is pretty recent. And USC ended up giving this response that pretty much echoes what they told Pali Legal. Like, no, we did not break the Leonard law. We didn't do this. And the reason why we're removing Yasmin is because she's not a representative of Freshman Academy. Essentially, my position was a TA. I was a TA for a class, and it's for first year students. So they said that my speech means that it doesn't reflect a role model who represents USC Viterbi.
Yasmin's case has surpassed the traditional Zionist media network and has now entered far right and conservative media spaces as well. Coordinated attacks against her online continue, pressing heavily for her university to take action against her. However, even that didn't shock me as much as hearing that she received a home visit from the FBI.
The FBI came to my house, and I got a knock at the door, and my sister answered because I was at work. I wasn't home. My sister answered the door, and she was like, can I help you? Because she thought they were insurance workers with the way that they were dressed. And they were like, oh, we're here to speak to Yasmin Mashayakh. And my sister's like, I'm sorry, who are you? So they pulled out their badges, and they're like, FBI, we're here to speak with Yasmin Mashayakh. And she said that they had printouts of my tweets on like a folder. And I told her to just, she called me, and I'm like, just take their number and like, take their number, put it on a note, whatever, take their card, and we'll call them back. Tell them her lawyer will reach out to you. So they ended up not giving me a card. They gave her like a phone number with the agent's name on like a sheet of paper. And it was like torn out of a legal pad, and she gave it to me, and I pass it to like my lawyer from Pal Legal, and they call, and she's like, this is just the general FBI number. So she asked for the person whose name was written on there. And they were just like, she was like, oh, we want to meet with Yasmin, or like, we want to meet with both of you, obviously, because like, now they know I have a lawyer, want to meet with both of you. So she was like, okay, well, let me talk to my client and I'll get back to you. So she's like, what's your number? And the FBI agent wouldn't give the number. And my lawyer is just like, why not? And then she was just like, well, we don't want your client posting it online because she posts a lot of things. And I can't meet with her alone. My partner has to come with me.
From these three conversations alone, we can see the intense level of pressure being put on Palestinians who utilize digital spaces and how these spaces have been weaponized. Despite this all, my interviewees reiterated that they would not stop speaking out or utilizing digital platforms to express their Palestinian identity. Digital spaces are being reclaimed by Palestinians despite the risks. Now the question is, what will it take for these coordinated campaigns against Palestinians online to be rejected as the racist attacks that they are? A heartfelt thank you to my interviewees for speaking with me about such a personal issue. Included in the blog post below are more sources on how Palestinians are fighting back against the weaponization of digital spaces, be it from coordinated Zionist attacks or from tech companies themselves. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Status Audio Magazine. The Status is produced by the Arab Studies Institute in partnership with Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, co-sponsored by George Mason University's Middle Eastern Studies Program and the American University of Beirut's Asfari Institute for Civil Society and Citizenship. To listen to more conversations, on-the-scene reports, and discussions, visit our website, statushour.com, or subscribe via iTunes and listen to us on the go. You can also friend us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Thanks for listening, and for more conversations, please visit statushour.com.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
The sound of this doorbell may seem pretty ordinary to you, until you realize that it's Graham, who's 75 years old and still delivering meals to people in need in his neighborhood. And that for many of them, it's the most comforting sound they'll hear all day. Seniors bring so much to Quebec. Let's recognize their contribution. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.